Today's podcast is with Joshua Hanna, and it is probably one of my favorite episodes of all time here on Universe of Game. We've done a lot of episodes, but this one is absolutely incredible because it's about one of my favorite subjects and one of the most interesting and compelling subjects that not a lot of people have realized, and that is the immense amount of research given to us by the greatest researcher of all time, in my opinion, on reincarnation. His name is Dr. Ian Stevenson. Now, Josh knows Dr. Ian Stevenson's work so well because his great-grandfather also worked at the University of Virginia at a high level. So this is an incredible conversation combining science and spirituality, and I invite you to open up your mind to the possibilities of what could be. I feel like it'd be a good place to start off with kind of your background, because usually it's boring when I ask people about their background, but it's, I don't really think it is, you know, because it sets up what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
So...
Well, when we first connected, it was on the subject of Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was actually the predecessor of my great-grandfather, Dr. David C. Wilson, who founded the Department of both Neurology and Psychiatry that Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was famous for studying reincarnation, he took over that department from my great-grandpa. And basically, I grew up knowing all the men in the matriarchal lineage of my family were all these, like, you know, famous, renowned PhDs and doctors and medical scientists. David C. Wilson being, you know, pretty much one of the founding fathers of, like, the Western neuroscience academic methodology. So, yeah, I think I've always been fascinated by health and medicine. And I went to school for holistic medicine, got super deep into studying yoga and meditation, and just passionate about all things health and wellness and peak performance. So I kind of moved in a different direction where a lot of the, you know, at least my, like, family heritage is kind of in this very academic, like, hardcore reductionist neuroscience mentality. And I had a really profound spiritual awakening at a young age. And so I moved more into yoga and meditation and the holistic modalities.
So we were just talking about how a lot of people know who Ian Stevenson is, that he was a guy at University of Virginia. I think that his work is some of the best evidence we've had of reincarnation. And I've said this like 20 different times because I really, truly think so, because it's not something you can refute as far as... If they have birthmarks on their body that are very similar to, you know, what they claim to remember, and that they can find their own bodies from their past life and solve crimes and stuff, like, you probably know this stuff better than I do. But if that's possible, I feel like that's way more evidence than subjective. Because unfortunately, the problem is that you can just, it's not a problem, but the thing is you can just make stuff up. And a lot of people do make stuff up, and that's important to recognize. But when you have the work that your grandpa did, you know, it's hard to refute, you know, so he came before Ian Stevenson. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think that's what people really need to understand is that these guys were legitimately the OG neuroscientists, right? So at this period of time, neuroscience wasn't a totally integral entity. There was neurology, right, which is the study of the brain and the nervous system, and then there was psychology, and psychiatry hadn't come into its full existence yet. So there was this in medicine, there was a really deep separation between the mind and the body, and so basically, the psychological framework was more of a Freudian framework. So if anyone was suffering from depression or certain types of mental illness, it was treated purely from a psychological perspective. And they had a lot of problems with things like schizophrenia. Whereas neurology mainly focused in, you know, seizure disorders and any kind of classic, like sensory motor issues with the brain. And what happened with my great-grandfather is he fought for the convergence of mind-body medicine. And this ended up being, in that period of time, it was called neuropsychiatry. So he founded both the Department of Neurology and Psychiatry, which is what Dr. Ian Stevenson took over, but he really pushed to integrate them together. So there was this new kind of science, which became psychiatry, whether people hate it or love it, but it was a science of understanding how the chemistry of the body really affects the experience of the mind. And they started understanding how, you know, schizophrenia and other mental illnesses have a lot to do with actual biochemistry and neurotransmitters. But that was all happening at that time. So when people want to say, you know, oh, Dr. Ian Stevenson was a quack and, you know, anything that's refuting what he was doing, they really need to understand that these guys were like hardcore scientists and at the very beginning of the Western neuroscience movement.
Like, they have some real stuff behind them.
Yeah, exactly. That's
what you're saying.
Yeah.
So when you think about his work, what do you think some of the most profound parts of it are? What are some interesting things that you find? Because some people might be like, I've never even heard of.
Yeah.
Well, who is Ian Stevenson? You know, I've never heard of any of this. So what are we talking about?
So Dr. Ian Stevenson became so famous because he was kind of a, as a scientist, he was a bit of a renegade, venturing into territory like reincarnation, and especially being in a chair position for neurology and psychiatry at a major university. He was subject to a lot of criticism for going after a subject like reincarnation. But the reason that it happened is because he dealt with so much mental illness and so many people that were trying to heal, you know, psychiatric problems. There was this reoccurring theme where people would bring in their children, and these children could like had specific, extremely specific memories of their previous past life identities. And it started happening so consistently that he began to take a really serious interest in it. And that's when things shifted, because most people in the industry, especially on the academic side, would just immediately discredit anything like that that came through.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because scientists are really taught reductionism, right? So it's like anything that has to do with spirituality, anything that has to do with philosophy, isn't in the department of like a materialist reductionist scientific framework, right? So it's like, if you can't measure it, then it probably doesn't exist, is the academic framework of thought. But Dr. Ian Stevenson was fascinated by the subject.
That was Descartes, right? That came up with that. And that wasn't in like the...
Right.
That was what was that? 17th, 18th century. It's kind of funny that you say it like that, because it's like hundreds of years. It's a big difference.
Yeah.
But you know, that I think there was a, it's funny when we talk about these point of views, because people think that just because, and I was thinking about making a video about this.
Yeah.
People don't understand that if you go back to ancient Greece, for example, even before then, Aristotle and Plato, these guys had a belief in a soul of some sort, and they had a belief in a lot of the things that you might call panpsychist now, or you might call idealism, that there's some fundamental building block that we can't understand. And so it wasn't until we had people like Descartes come in and basically be like, well, if you can't reduce it, that's exactly what you said, right? If you can't reduce it to something small, then, and you can't measure it, then it isn't there, versus the traditional thousands of years old perspective, which is there's something called a force of spirit. You know, not saying Star Wars is thousands of years old, but I'm saying there's a field of energy,
right,
whatever it's been called. And so that's what I find interesting, is that reincarnation is kind of like it's part of the Hindu culture that came from that Indus Valley. Came from that area. Hindu saying that word in itself isn't really accurate, because it's a bunch of different stuff and it's kind of colonialism that called them that. But the Vedas, I'm referring to, like,
right,
the Upanishads, the ancient texts, like, they talked about these things. So it's not a new thing.
This is the most ancient religions that we know of on the planet.
They say that, yeah.
Yeah.
They say that India is the mother of all mysticism.
Absolutely.
And things like that. So as you research his work and Do you ever have any interesting conversations? Like, what did your family say about this stuff? Like, I'm curious because I want to know the indie, the stuff that most people don't know.
So before you and I scheduled this podcast, I actually interviewed my 99-year-old grandma about this because she has just a wealth of knowledge and she's sharp as a tack, which is amazing at 99. And yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that she stressed is that Dr. Ian, people that she wanted people to know just in general, based on our family relationship to this, is that Dr. Ian Stevenson was a highly respected academic. You know, so I think what made him brilliant is that he was well educated and efficient in reductionist materialist science. But at the same time, he understood that not everything can be measured and quantitized, especially what, you know, what we refer to as metaphysics could just be science that we don't have the tools to measure yet. So what Ian Stevenson did is he actually created a system that encouraged skepticism, right? So that's the other thing. He wasn't just like some scientist who was a believer in reincarnation. He actually wasn't at first at all. He was just completely fascinated by the consistency of these children who could remember exact details of their past lives. So what he did is he wanted to get to the bottom of this. And at first it was kind of just like a hobby expression of his existing work, right? And so he's like, okay, this is happening enough. And now that I have a reputation for this, people are telling me these stories from all over the world. He's getting letters. He's learning about cases that are just absolutely absurd. Children that could remember names of their family members, of where they lived, of how they died. People that were killed. Like that was actually the most consistent thing, is he said that people who died traumatically and violently had the strongest recall. Because in his perspective, if this was a real phenomenon, it was most likely due to the fact that there was such an intense emotional experience at the moment of death that somehow the psyche brought that through into its next experience. And so what he did is he was like, let's figure out how to use the scientific method to encourage skepticism and really isolate if this could be real. And because there's so many people in the world, I'm not willing to discredit it, right? Because there's millions of people who think that reincarnation is a fact. I can't, as a scientist, just say, oh, that's not true. That would be arrogant, right? So he was aware.
Well, people do that.
Oh, yeah. And that's, as one of these OG neuroscientific, you know, neuropsychiatrists, I think it's really beautiful and humbling that he was like, I don't want to be arrogant because this is such a huge part of world belief. Let's look at this scientifically and figure out if we can create an objective scientific method to see if there's any truth in reality here. And so what he did is he made a framework, right? So they categorized and organized thousands of these cases and they researched every single one. So he built a team that would get a backlog of information about the person who's coming in. And then they isolated it into basically these interpretations of the cases. One would be just like, let's just say if the first one that everyone who's a skeptic is going to think is it's just fraud, right? And there was fraud. So because people want publicity and people want to, you know, to have recognition, people actually do create fraudulent things around this.
In spirits community, there's...
Oh, yeah.
In spirit, it's rampant. And still now.
Extraterrestrials and alien contact and spiritual stuff. Like, there's...
he said it!
There's so much.
It's so true.
So the number one thing in the categories was fraud. Let's see if we can prove that these cases are fraudulent, right? So that was number one on the list. The second was fantasy, right? So just people are imagining things. So one is people are almost maliciously creating stories to get attention. One is it's just these woo-woo people who are making fantasies. Oh, I was Cleopatra in my past life, or, you know, whatever, these things that you hear all the time. So that would be categorized as fantasy. And then cryptonesia, which I believe is people like hearing things, like maybe children hearing stories about things and then making things up so that there was actually information that was coming from somewhere. And that goes into to paramnesia, which is along the same lines. It's just basically receiving information from an outside source, but believing it's true and being able to convince yourself that it's true. The fifth one is where it gets a little bit more metaphysical. His fifth category was possible genetic memory. Like even at this stage, the scientists were really curious about, you know, because of, you know, just what we know about genetic evolution, if our actual DNA can hold memory of some type that are that where we could remember things that our ancestors experienced, right? So that was his fifth explanation. And then paranormal processes. So this is where it became a little bit more fascinating, and he was willing to consider that any of this could be true, right? A good scientist, based on their bias or their almost discrimination, won't discount anything until it can be proven, right? So then it got into extrasensory perception combined with the development of a secondary personality, which meant that maybe some of these people possessed an authentic type of extrasensory perception, and they were drawing information from a universal field of information, right? Like if our minds can somehow, you know, people refer to this maybe as like the Akashic records, where our minds can maybe integrate into some greater field of information and draw information through that, like maybe other people's memories who died. And then we install those programs on ourselves, and we think we were those people, right? So that was one of his categories, extrasensory perception with the development of a secondary personality. Seven was then possession, like spirit possession, if that was real, and maybe these people who were remembering things were actually being influenced by some disincarnate, you know, psychic intelligence of a person who'd previously lived. And then they were somehow being influenced by an external, let's use the word entity, right? And then the eighth and final category was true and authentic reincarnation, meaning that a person could actually leave their physical body, die, move into some type of a purely psychic reality, a reality of some pure consciousness, and then back into a new form with an imprint of that previous life experience. So that was basically his scientific framework. And every single one of these thousands and thousands of cases that they studied was categorized into one of those areas.
What do you think about all that?
So as far as like that becoming part of a scientific method, I don't think that there is any other way that you could measure that, you know, and especially with the scientific framework that everything is biochemistry, right? Life itself, consciousness is just cells that have come together and eventually become aware based on some survival need or something like that. If you put everything into a reductionist lens, then yeah, this doesn't fit into the scientific method. However, if you're a scientist and you're willing to acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know, and that there might be thousands and thousands of years of future evolution where we can learn things that we have no idea and no understanding of now, I think that what he was doing was absolutely brilliant, because he had such extraordinary cases and such extraordinary evidence. And once they sorted through the cases that were fraudulent, the cases that were being informed, and they started categorizing cases that had no explanation, like that had absolutely zero logical basis to exist, then reincarnation actually started to seem like the most likely reality for a lot of these cases.
Hey, I just wanted to let you know, if you're getting value out of what Josh is talking about and really Josh's insights, I would actually really highly recommend that you check out Josh as he leads a breathwork journey on the challenge that I'm releasing on June 14th called the 7 Days to Timeline Shift Challenge. I was so moved by this podcast when we filmed it that I decided I wanted to have Josh be a part of the challenge that I was releasing, and I wanted to have him start it out out by doing an incredible breathwork journey. So Josh is leading one on day one to begin the 7-day challenge, which is supposed to be very similar to what you would get at a retreat, but without the cost and without the time commitment. And so this is supposed to give you that feel of a genuine challenge. Like, can you challenge yourself to shift your timeline? That's what this is about. If you want to participate in that, I would highly, highly recommend it. And the link is in the description below. So with Ian, what was his experience with it? Did he think? Was he convinced, or was he just on the fence? You know, it's interesting because as a scientific guy, I think we need that too. Because if everyone was like me and they didn't, you know, go through the schooling, I think the schooling can help to lend credibility, because I feel like we're in this precipice where there's so many people that still are convinced that you need somebody who has this amount of credentials to do that.
Right.
And so I do think that that's helpful for a certain amount of people, but there's also a different types of people who are like, okay, what is the evidence you've got? Is that enough? Yeah. Then there's people that just blindly believe shit.
Yeah.
So I think that it's good, because I think a lot of the work that I try to do is link the science and the spirituality. And I really find it fascinating that that's kind of what he was doing.
Yeah.
So what do you think about Ian? And if you have the answer to what he thought, if you don't know what he thought, I don't know if you're in his, if you know that, but if you don't, like, what do you think in general just about the reincarnation phenomena yourself?
So I'll make an analogy if I can. Another scientist who I really admire the work of is Dr. Rick Strassman, who wrote DMT,
Spirit Molecule.
Yeah. And I've gotten to have several deep conversations with him, which was an incredible privilege. Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, shit, that's awesome.
Yeah, so he's a really interesting character, and I'm gonna tie this all together. So he's someone who came in, who is a scientist, right? Another neuroscientist, who was the only person that was ever given permission by the DEA to get DMT, and with all the institutional approval processes, actually administer DMT to hundreds of people, which is absolutely crazy. So Dr. Rick Strassman is one of these characters that's in the realm of, it's not even pseudoscience. It's just like, It's like science that the general institutions are like not willing to look at, right? Almost like barred science. And so he got through all the red tape with the DEA and all the institutions, and he was able to administer DMT to a lot of people. And the reason why he did it is because he wanted to know why not just like psychotic schizophrenic experiences, but like why some people have these really prolific spiritual experiences, how that could have a basis in neurochemistry and if it can be reproduced. So DMT was the most likely compound because it's synthesized in the body, and we know that our brain can release endogenous amounts of DMT, right? So we know that in the pineal gland, DMT is produced, as well as melatonin. Our pineal gland is what modulates our circadian rhythm. So DMT is only one methylation process away from melatonin, right? So dimethyltryptamine means tryptamine, which is produced by our pineal gland, methylated twice, right? So just two little tweaks in that molecule and you have DMT. So he was one of these scientists who was absolutely fascinated by mystical experiences, kind of like Ian Stevenson, right? Fascinated, but highly objective. And, you know, maybe there's a very strong reason to be skeptical. Maybe none of this is real. It's just biochemical. But he went into his DMT research not being a psychonaut. He went into it being a scientist. And he was excited because as he moved into the work that he did with hundreds of people, literally the greatest data that's ever been collected on DMT is in the possession of Dr. Rick Strassman. And the way he described the process to me when we spoke is that he went into his case studies and his research being highly skeptical, you know, that, oh, these people are just hallucinating. But then people started to have the exact same experiences psychically in their psychedelic experiences. They would literally encounter the same beings, the same, like, that look and were described identically, the same dimensional experiences where they felt like they were expanding outside of their bodies and moving into these multidimensional frameworks of reality, but that were absolutely identical. And these were people who didn't know each other, who'd never spoken, and this happened time and time and time again. Eventually, Dr. Rick Strassman, I think, tried DMT on himself. And it was all being injected. So it wasn't like smoking DMT and having a quick experience. This was a very prolific and profound DMT experience that they were facilitating. And he basically went from being a skeptic to, after experiencing it and seeing this many people having these same experiences, to then, as a scientist, saying, I think there's something very real that's happening here. I think that there's elements to the mind that we don't understand. And I think that we live in a universe that's greater than three dimensions, right? And because our brain has only evolved to perceive three dimensions, physics knows that there's more than three dimensions. That's basic geometry and physics. We know that we don't live in a three-dimensional universe. However, our brains have been hardwired to only experience a three-dimensional reality. So Strassman is a great example of a scientist who went into metaphysical research and was kind of converted into more of an agnostic and like, I don't know what's going on, but I think there's a lot more to consciousness and life than we have any idea of, you know? And Ian Stevenson is the same way, where he went into this research skeptical, just wanting to study a very strange phenomenon because of the unimaginable detail that was being expressed by these children. Once they sorted through fraud and fabrication and information absorption, and they started getting into these cases that were completely impossible that these children could be faking, that's when things got fascinating for him. And he dove really, really, really deep into the research, and I think changed that perspective into one of openness. And instead of this arrogant, you know, we have this archetype of this arrogant scientific reductionist materialist who's just like, I don't believe in anything. The mind is just the processes of the brain and neurons and nothing else exists. Like, not all neuroscientists are like that. You know, Ian Stevenson, Strassman, there's a ton of them now who are basically just like, we don't know what the hell's going on. And this brain is like a holographic, multidimensional generation machine that consciousness is a substrate of, but we have no idea really what's going on beyond that. And I think that Ian Stevenson really fit into that category, where he was a brilliant scientist, academic, highly respected, and he just was like, we don't actually know what's going on, you know? And for me, like, as someone who also is a health scientist, I love that.
Me too, man. I think that's what really does it for me. That really gets me going.
Yeah.
Just thinking about stuff that we can scientifically measure as well, because I think that is the future of actually changing the opinions of people who are not willing to try to subjectively experience it yourself, if you can, right? Because you're talking about how you could produce DMT yourself. There are some people that say that they've done it in meditation, they've experienced DMT like states, breath, right? You're big into that. You even lead stuff. You do DMT breath?
Oh my, that's exactly what we do.
Okay.
So basically I lead these hour long psychedelic journeys that are really safe for people. You know, I've done a lot of work with people who've been actually injured by psychedelics, specifically ayahuasca. And
what do you mean by injured exactly? I'm just very curious.
Like people who went into ceremonies and ended up having like psychotic breaks and like really profoundly disturbing experiences that didn't lead to a greater sense of wholeness, but led to like crisis states that lasted for years. And yeah, people can actually get really injured in certain types of these psychedelic experiences and ceremonies. So with the breath work, it's a really safe way, because as you breathe, the way that DMT hypothetically is released during breath work is through this interlink between the lungs and the brain. And as you do this deep rhythmic breathing, the way that in your system, there's two types of DMT that can affect the human brain. One is exogenous DMT, which means coming from something outside of the body and in nature, like acacia and ayahuasca. And there's tons of Mimosa hostilis. There's tons of plants that contain DMT, and we can isolate it or we can make it synthetic. That's all exogenous DMT. Endogenous DMT, which is again what I think Strassman is also most fascinated by now, Dr. Rick Strassman, is endogenous DMT is DMT that's actually produced in the body. And one of the ways that we're discovering, Wim Hof talks a lot about this, is we can get that DMT to release through this deep rhythmic breathing. And when you do that, those parts of the brain are really highly articulated and refined. So when you can get DMT to release on an endogenous level, there's a way lower chance of like overloading your nervous system, or your sensory systems in your brain. Yeah.
So there are different experience. Have you experienced the external?
Yeah.
And the internal? You've done them both.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think the difference is?
Like I would say that it's more buffered, right? So it's like if you get a, you know, let's say you get a big vaporizer machine and you put a huge chunk of DMT in there and you just like hit it and hit it and hit it till you have a breakthrough. You might have an experience that is really, really brutal. You know, it can be DMT, whether it's 5-MeO or NMDMT, can create beautiful experiences where you have insights into these greater dimensional realities, but they can also sometimes be extremely disturbing, and create a lot of psychological harm for some people, not for everyone. But I think that when you have an endogenous DMT experience, you're not forcing the upregulation of DMT in your system, right? So it's like you can't overdo it. And just like with any chemical that you put in your body, alcohol, THC, everyone's had that experience who's ever eaten a THC edible where just too much.
Yep.
And then like they're having like the worst trip of their lives because they ate too much THC.
Yeah.
So DMT is not immune to that. You smoke too much DMT, you can go way off into a place that's fucking terrifying, and you come and can come back really shaken. So with endogenous DMT, I feel like the body has an ability to regulate those experiences really well. They're very integrated. And when we do it in the work that I do, we basically lead a deep breath sequence until you really can feel this intense energy in your body and vibration. And then I lead it into about an hour long sound journey so that the whole thing can be integrated. I was just actually asked recently what my favorite psychedelic is. And I said, breath.
People don't realize the power of that.
It's so powerful.
That you can just do it yourself.
Yeah.
That you don't need to do that. Do you think that there's a reason that some people psychologically have bad trips? Do you think it has to do with their own state? Do you think it's random? Or do you see people that are struggling more, that have more problems? Is there any correlation that you've kind of discovered? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually, among the many projects that I'm doing, right now I'm focusing on this project called MetaHuman, which is like a cognitive enhancement protocol and a supplement line that's really designed to help people's brains work in the highest states that are humanly possible. But before I was working on that project, I actually went through a 2-year process where a friend of mine and I founded a platform called Holistic Evolution. And we were working specifically with people who had crises in psychedelic experiences, and helping them figure out how to recover in a state of like really intense disassociation, right? So usually if people have a profoundly difficult psychedelic experience, it can result in a deep depersonalization, depression, their sense of self deteriorates, and they can kind of move into a field where they just feel out of sync with everything. And so what I've found is that most frequently happens to people who go way further. I think that's the first part, way, way further than they even understood is possible. So when you look at human beings as individuals, right? People like to generalize things. But when you look at human beings as individuals, there's a great variance in sensitivity, right? Like some people can do hard drugs like cocaine and MDMA and do drugs a lot and not have any really negative consequences, like unless it's like severe addiction. And some people like myself, if I took MDMA or some type of a drug like that, my body would freak out because I'm highly sensitive. My biochemistry is highly sensitive to psychoactive compounds. So I think that sensitivity and dose is a really, really big part of it. And Strassman is another person that he kind of agrees with that. Like people really need to know what their dose to sensitivity ratio is. And then also genetic predispositions to biological processes. Like a lot of, we're finding out in neuroscience now that a lot of biological mental illness is created by problems in methylation, right? So like the body isn't able to methylate and manufacture these molecules that turn into dopamine and serotonin. Like for instance, tryptophan turns into 5-HTP, turns into serotonin. So if someone's having a problem with methylation, their body will not convert the neurotransmitters properly. And then they have like really bad problems with depression, not because there's something intrinsically psychologically wrong with them, but because their brain is literally not making serotonin. And a brain that's not making serotonin is almost like a brain that doesn't have any ketones or fats or glucose to run. It just like exists in this really depressed state. And there's different types of depression. Some can be very psychological and emotional too. But I think that there is a genetic component. Like some people who are kind of more genetically predisposed to having problems with psychoactive drugs need to be very careful with psychedelics. And then people maybe who have a lot of really deep trauma and existing fragmentation of the psyche, because the experience can be so profound that you can take someone who's in kind of a wounded, fragmented state of being, and that can actually get worse, like going from like PTSD to like complex PTSD.
Interesting. So how do you think people can figure out how sensitive they are? Is there a way that you've done that within yourself? Or is there a test or?
Sensitive to psychedelics. I mean, so I just spoke on a psychedelic panel at this amazing conference in Los Angeles called HealthSpan. And it's basically like all the world leaders in health science and biohacking and biotechnology are all converging at these different points. HealthSpan is one of them. And I was invited to do a presentation about psychedelics because of this work that we've done with people rehabilitating from psychedelic crisis states. And, you know, sensitivity, I think that if people generally have problems with like drinking or weed or anything, and they feel really imbalanced afterwards, that's a really strong sign of like a biochemical sensitivity, because some people can drink all night and wake up and barely have a hangover, you know? So it's like people, I think generally should be working on a relationship with their body to where they can have a felt sense of how sensitive they are. Like even we were talking about sugar earlier, right?
You were, yeah.
So like, I know I can't eat very much sugar. It's not good for my body.
So you just kind of trial and see what works.
Yeah, right. You gauge it, right? And then if to get more sophisticated, you can wear, you know, biometric scanners. So you could have like an Aura ring or something like that. And
I have a Whoop.
You have a Whoop? Okay, yeah. So you could basically wear that while you have a psychedelic experience, and it could tell you how crazy your heart rate variability and biometrics get. And then what I was advocating for in this at HealthSpan was we really actually need to legalize psychedelics entirely so that we can have, you know, grants and resources come on so that scientists can actually identify the genes. Psychedelic therapy is becoming so popular now that we actually really need to know what puts people in at-risk categories, even on like a genetic, on a genomic basis.
So you've done work with people who struggle with psychedelics, right? Or have struggled. What do you think some of the biggest, like, reoccurring reasons? Is it just too much? Did it just take too much? Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, it's, I think,
or it's, is it like even low doses, people just mess things up? Is there like, I guess this is a hard question, but are people like mentally loose before they take it and that makes them looser? Or do you feel like that has anything to do with, like, if someone already has a strong grasp, or I could be just, you know, fabricating that. Because I just wonder, you know, yeah. because maybe if you take too much, even if you are logically like really into it, that could still like break that up. Like, do you feel like it almost breaks someone's psyche apart? And what even makes the psyche in your experience, you know?
So that's a really good question. I think that that's actually probably at the cutting edge of neuroscience right now, is this question. And one thing that we do know about the brain is that it is the most complex physical thing that exists in the universe, right? So the level of complexity that we have when we're working with the brain and with the nervous system, especially how it correlates to the experience of awareness or consciousness or the psyche, there's so much there that we barely understand it. And so people will understand one aspect of that and then apply it to everything, like a generalization. Like, oh, you had a bad trip on psychedelics, like you have more work to do. You know what I mean? Or, oh, you had a really traumatic experience on psychedelics, you probably have a genetic predisposition to a mental illness, you know? So all of those things could be uniquely true in individual experiences or on a case-by-case basis. And I think that's what makes this really difficult. But what I've seen as definitely something that's a consistency doing this work with hundreds of people is that it's too much too fast, right? Too much changes in brain chemistry, too profound of an experience, if the experience goes dark, too much intensity of like really dark, scary feelings and experiences, that the shadow or whatever, too much of that. And when you put too much pressure on a psyche, you can create a fragmentation, right? Like an over leveraged nervous system and psyche can split almost, right? And then you end up with all these various DSM diagnoses, PTSD, complex PTSD, depersonalization disorder, derealization. Really fundamentally what I think that is when the nervous system gets so overloaded, it has a tendency to fragment. And so for most people, I say, if you're interested in psychedelics, be really cautious. You know, you don't more, we're not in the era of Terrence McKenna anymore. You know, you don't need to go sit in a closet and take 5 grams of mushrooms. You know, we're more in the era of like microdosing, where it's like, take a little bit and like, see how that feels, you know, see what feels safe, move with it intuitively, build a relationship with it. You know, if people want to take mushrooms, I tell them it's better to take a small amount a little more frequently and develop a relationship with it than it is to take a huge amount and risk a psychically fragmenting experience. But generally speaking, if people really deeply desire to progress spiritually and evolve, I think that the basis of that spiritual evolution is the same that it's been all throughout history. And it really comes down to the breath, you know, really learning how to regulate your breath, because through breath regulation, you regulate all the chemical processes in your body, and you regulate your autonomic nervous system. So breath is fundamental, and then breath leads to meditation, which leads to higher states of consciousness. And this is literally what the entire system of yoga is based on.
When you're talking about yoga, what do you know about yoga?
Man, that's a great question. Yoga is one of my favorite subjects, actually. I love yoga so, so, so much. It's one of my greatest life passions.
We're not talking about stretching.
I mean, stretching is a part of it, right? So
sure.
Yeah. So most people hear the word yoga and they think that yoga is doing all the stretches and the things, you know?
Yeah.
That's
what I was making fun of.
Right. Yeah. So that's actually only one limb of 8 limbs of yoga, right? So that practice is actually called asana. And unfortunately, there's, you know, with kind of cultural adaptation within different world cultures, dare I say cultural appropriation, but just like in general, when one culture adapts and adopts something from another, a lot of the greater picture can be left out. And such is the case with yoga. Yoga actually means union. It means to join. And so the asana, the physical practice of yoga, is actually, as one branch of yoga, is about preparing the physical body to be fit, basically, to develop symmetry within your nervous system and your muscular system, and to develop a relationship between your breath and the way that your body moves. But the entire system of asana was actually developed to prepare new aspirants on the path of yoga to be able to move into deeper practices like Raja Yoga or Kriya Yoga, which is completely an internal process, which has to do with elevating the mind and experiencing higher states of existence and consciousness.
You think there's any science
to back that up? There's so much science now. Yoga, I think that's one of the great beauties of yoga, is that it's always been a science. Like for thousands of years, yoga has been treated as a science in India and Tibet and Nepal and all over the Eastern world. And now with this kind of advent of biometric analysis and data analysis and modern Western science, there's actually a big convergence between yoga and neuroscience and just basic biochemistry that's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, I remember reading Yogananda's interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita, and it says on the cover, the science of God realization.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I do really think there's a lot more to it than what people understand. Yeah. You know, so what do you think is some of the, do you have any off the top of your head that you remember any science that comes to mind about yoga or about some of these principles? You know, we talked about really what Stevenson did was the science of the reincarnation aspect of yoga. And they could, because I, from what I understand, tell me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. This could be wrong. Could be mixing Hindu and yoga. Could we just distinguish? What do you think the difference is between what people see as Hinduism and yoga?
That's a good question. So Hinduism is absolutely integrated with yoga in Indian culture. But yoga, it can also be looked at as something that's independent from Hinduism, because sects of Buddhism integrate yoga. And yoga is even thought of in many sects and precincts of India as an autonomous practice, right? For self-realization or God realization. And you brought Yogananda into this, so we can dive into that a little bit. But Yogananda brought a practice called Kriya Yoga to the United States really early on. Like, I think it was 1920 something. And so he was one of the first Indian yogis. He was the first Indian yogi who became a very prolific figure and led to this massive spread of yoga. Before him, I believe it was Swami Vivekananda, I think, who was like the first Indian yogi to come over. And he didn't have an explosive revolution behind him, but Yogananda did. And so Yogananda is really seen as like the father of yoga in the West. And Yogananda's teachers, Sri Yukteswar Lahiri Mahasaya, and this very mysterious being known as Maha Avatar Babaji, they all directed Yogananda's movement to the West, because they knew that specifically the United States of America would become a hugely influential force in the world. And so Yogananda came to teach Kriya Yoga, because it's a scientific practice of elevating the mind, and that anyone can learn. And that was his whole mission, was to come here to teach the science of yoga. And in fact, his first demographic, people don't realize this, but his first demographic where he was teaching yoga to was actually Christian people.
Really? Okay. So do you think he accomplished his mission?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, Yogananda's mission was to make yoga accessible to Americans and for it to be a launching pad to spread yoga all over the entire world. And so I do believe that Yogananda definitely accomplished this. And it's funny, because his mission, though, was the higher aspects of yoga, right? Raja yoga, Kriya yoga, these practices that are dealing directly with the mind and consciousness and the soul, and also our relationship to the universal principle of consciousness that we could refer to as God or Brahma or the oneness creator. There's a name for it in every different religion, but fundamentally yoga is to join your individual self with this greater universal self.
Do you think it's possible for everyone?
I think if anyone who desires to have that experience, and it's interesting, we can even pivot it to psychedelics, because I think a lot of people are drawn to psychedelics to have a very profound spiritual experience. But then there's all the pitfalls and the challenges and the potential dangers for some people within that realm. So yoga is this very safe, gradual process. The problem with it is that it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of self-discipline to experience higher states of consciousness through meditation. So I do think it's possible for everyone, but I don't think that everyone is at the stage of their life where they're willing to really completely put in the effort and the discipline and the work and build their life in a way that facilitates that process. And so anyone that's interested in it, they're absolutely capable. They just have to be ready to commit, you know, and if you want to really have profoundly powerful spiritual experiences and enter into these higher states, you have to be ready to commit to the process.
Are those states the same as psychedelic states? Because why would you put in all the work if you could just take this little thing right here to get you right there
right.
in 5 minutes? You
know? Well, so another person who we'll bring into the equation, right, is a man who was known as Ram Dass. So Ram Dass is really dear to my heart. And I actually live at a neighboring property to his in Maui. And I've spent a lot of time at Ram Dass's temple and property. And it's called the Hanuman Center in Maui. Ram Dass is this like absolutely beautiful example of someone who thought that psychedelics were the solution to all of the problems that human beings are facing, literally. And him and Timothy Leary were the two most powerful figures in psychedelics out of Harvard, right? So when that movement happened in the 60s, it happened because specifically those two men amassed a huge following, and you know, what was it, Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out, and then Ram Dass's work, where they were literally taking LSD like every day for a while. And Ram Dass, he knew that he could elevate his mind using LSD, right? And that's not everybody's experiences. I know people who've had horrifying experiences on LSD, but Ram Dass was this very unique person where he could elevate his state of consciousness using LSD, and he became devoted to it before he knew about yoga, right? So before he knew about these mystics and yogis and sages, he was just like a devotee to LSD. And they would do these deep immersions where they would rent a house and take LSD every day for a week. And then he got frustrated. And this is why this story is so beautiful in this conversation, is that Ram Dass became so frustrated because he always had to come down. And he would get into these higher states of experience, and then he'd crash really hard. And he'd feel incredibly depressed. And he couldn't figure out how to use psychedelics to sustain an expanded state of consciousness where he felt free and connected to the universe, right? Because that's what the goal is for these people that are exploring this, is that they feel out of the rat race. I mean, I feel like even that whole 60s, 70s hippie movement, people wanted out of this industrialist rat race and to experience this greater sense of connectivity, which is yoga, right? But Ram Dass, same thing every time. As a scientist, again, another scientist, a psychologist, he would take all these psychedelics and psilocybin and LSD and, you know, and then crash and depression and just struggling and trying to get back up, until he got to a point where he learned about yoga and he learned about these masters. And then he was like, I'm going to go and explore India, and I'm going to go sit with holy men and mystics and yogis, and I'm going to try and understand if they know what LSD is and how LSD is bringing people into these higher states of consciousness, and if it can be reproduced without it, and what happens if I give them LSD? So Ram Dass went on tour, and he was literally giving monks and yogis LSD and trying to learn about how to sustain higher states of consciousness. And in some cases, that didn't go so well. The real pivotal point in Ram Dass's life is when he met a yogi named Neem Karoli Baba, who was like a prolific master. And he came to him. He was skeptical at first. He was inquiring with him, Baba, we have this medicine in the West that can give you an experience of enlightenment, you know, that can show you God. And he was skeptical of it, you know, this yogic master. He'd never been exposed to anything like that, you know. He'd spent his whole life in meditation and practice and was an absolute master. And so Neem Karoli, this is like the best Ram Dass story of all time. So Neem Karoli Baba asks him, he says, okay, bring me the medicine. So Ram Dass brings like a whole jar full of LSD capsules and he hands it to him. Neem Karoli opens it. He pours like all the LSD capsules that were in this jar into his hand and he eats them all. And Ram Dass and his entourage were like freaked out. They were just like, oh my God, did this little Indian man just eat like an insane amount of hits of LSD, right? And so Maharaji, as he was known, Neem Karoli, he goes, he takes this and he sits in meditation for something like 8 hours, right? And he's just sitting there, he's going through the full psychedelic journey with the LSD. And everybody's kind of watching over him, like terrified that he might freak out, because with that dose, the things that we're talking about, like people having crisis states, psychosis, like almost these schizophrenic episodes.
Was that the biggest dose of all time?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to actually find someone in the community to ask like how many micrograms or whatever that actually was. And I'm sure that someone who's watching this video could probably find that out. But yeah, it was, I think, in the category of a heroic dose. And anyways, Maharaji comes out of this experience and he comes to Ram Dass and he says, interesting medicine. This is interesting medicine. He says, I don't think that it's necessary. And I think that it's possible that this medicine can show you the door of where you're trying to go, but it won't let you through. And that moment changed everything for Ram Dass. And when he saw this master consume this heroic amount of LSD and then tell him, this is not the path, and it won't let you through the door of what you truly desire to experience, everything changed for Ram Dass, because he saw something that was incredible, you know, for this little Indian man to do what he did. And then he really opened his heart to him and he became a disciple. So Ram Dass studied with Maharaji for years and years, and Maharaji informed every aspect and decision of his life. So here's the classic story of us, literally one of the pioneers of the psychedelic movement, turning his back on psychedelics and moving into yoga. Because after sitting with a master, he realized what he meant by that, by not being able to move through the door, is that when you take a chemical that expands your consciousness, there's only an aspect of you that's having the experience. It's just your mind, right? And you can experience maybe what we'd refer to as God. You can experience God for a moment and then it goes away. And even with Ram Dass, someone who was like a legend with how he took psychedelics, he was always depressed afterwards. He was always seeking. He wasn't finding anything. So what Maharaji meant is that you need to move through that doorway, the kingdom of heaven, as Jesus would put it. You need to move through that doorway with your entire being, right? With your heart. And in yoga, they call this bhakti, right? It's becoming devoted to God. And so Ram Dass became a super deep devotee of not a god in Hinduism, but a archetype in Hinduism called Hanuman. And Hanuman is basically the highest archetype of a devotee to God, someone who's completely devoted to the universal principle. And again, in Hinduism, they see God as this fundamental source of all life, of all consciousness, that's in all beings. And so Ram Dass's devotion to Hanuman was exactly symmetrical with Ram Dass's devotion to God and his own life. And he then spent the rest of his life becoming this leader of the heart, you know, becoming this leader, not of someone who was like, let's have a psychedelic mind-blowing experience. But it was more like, let's serve the world, right? Let's learn how to break through all of our obstructions to love. Let's go. And one of the things that Ram Dass was famous for, he sat with more people who were dying than almost any other modern spiritual leader that we have in history, right? He sat with hundreds and hundreds of people as they died, because that was the most vulnerable place that where those people needed support and love the most. So what Maharaji was ultimately teaching him is that a psychedelic might show you something that will be insightful, but it'll never bring you through. And to come through completely into this experience of merging with God and existing in a state like that all the time, it really deeply involves the heart. And we have to cultivate our ability to love ourselves and to love human beings and to love animals, to really truly love our environment, because again, in that perspective, God's in everything. So if you have the experience, but you don't have the love cultivated through service and devotion and action, you can't get through that gateway.
Ooh, shit. That's wild. That is probably the best story of all time on this podcast. I'll just give you that. That is absolutely fucking fascinating. Wow.
So, last story.
I'm just mind blown right now. Sorry.
It's okay. I'm just chilling. I'm gonna bring it all back, right? So from Dr. Rick Strassman to Ram Dass to LSD, mm-hmm. back to Ian Stevenson. This is a crazy fact in this conversation, and you'll really see the full synchronicity. Because my great-grandfather, who founded the Department of Psychiatry and Neurology, and his partner and colleague, Dr. Ian Stevenson, were two of the first people to ever take LSD. They took it together in a controlled environment. And it's just interesting how it all ties that history together, right? Because again, these guys were the early, early neuroscientists. My great-grandfather, Dr. Ian Stevenson, they weren't just psychiatrists, they were neurologists, right? And they were studying this mind-body relationship. So this is deep, you know? This is not like some stupid, fickle, hype-based, oh, this guy studied reincarnation. This is deep at the core of the development of neuroscience. And then Ram Dass, he took LSD, brought it huge into the mainstream, literally was one of the main people who created the Western psychedelic culture. And then he turned his back on it, you know? But where that began was with these other scientists who then kind of were consuming it as a research chemical. And that's where Ram Dass and Timothy Leary discovered it, was in through this circuit of medical scientists who were all consuming it and experiencing it as a research chemical. And Dr. Ian Stevenson and my great-grandpa were two of the first people to receive LSD and to take it in a research environment. And they both didn't like it. Like, it wasn't a good experience for them, I guess. They both said that they thought it was like more of like a model psychosis, like a way that people who don't have mental illness could experience these almost like states of schizophrenia. So they weren't two people that were, I think, highly engaged in spiritual practice. So maybe that's why they had that experience, but it wasn't something that really impressed them that deeply. And I just thought it's notable how it all ties together. And they were some of the first people that also took psychedelics.
So they were all kind of part of that same community.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's the story.
That's the story.
Man. Well, I think that's a great place to just drop the mic. I mean, can't really drop these, but hey, that was amazing. I really appreciate your ability to tell stories and to understand this knowledge. And it's not, like I kind of said at the beginning, I was, you know, we haven't talked that much. So I was really hoping that you'd live up to that. And like, yeah, I think this guy actually does know what he's talking about. And I really feel like after we had this conversation that, yeah, you have a deep knowledge of how the science links, you know. So as someone who has moved into this other field, you know, you're developing this other thing, what do you have going on with MetaHuman and the stuff that you're doing? Because we talked about right. a lot of the other stuff, but just you as a person, what's going on in your life and, you know, that area?
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. So, so basically, again, you know, my spiritual background is in Kriya Yoga, right? Which is what Yogananda brought to the States. And I was fortunate enough to go to an initiation ceremony in Mahavatar, Babaji, Lahiri Mahasaya, like all these saints in their original lineage. So I got to learn the original Kriya Yoga teachings and techniques. And that's been so powerful for me in my journey. So a lot of my spirituality is, I would say most of it is informed through those practices and through this deep, deep, profound yoga. But then on the science level, I went to school for naturopathy and holistic medicine and, you know, strength conditioning. And my passion has been peak performance, right? So how to get the human body, the nervous system into an optimal state. And now we're starting to call that biohacking, right? So I'm kind of right in between traditional yoga and the bio and like cutting edge, crazy next level biohacking science. So MetaHuman, which is MetaHuman.com, MetaHuman is kind of the culmination of those two passions for me, right? And so what we're working on right now is a type of a nootropic product, right? So people that know what nootropics are, it's like a supplement or like all these compounds that enhance the performance of your brain and your nervous system. So me and my research team, we've been developing a nootropic that I've never seen anything like this on the market. And really what we're trying to do is to create this supplement, this product that people can take on a daily basis, every single day. And it's not going to be like a stimulant where you take it and all of a sudden you're going into like Limitless or something like that. You know, the movie Limitless where he takes NZT, whatever. So it's not like that. It's more of like something that you take alongside with your meditation practice. You take it every day and it constantly is improving the biochemistry and the neurology of your brain and your nervous system. So essentially it's a long-term supplement that you stay on and you use it with your yoga, with your meditation, so that you can constantly improve the function of your brain and your nervous system, which is integral with Kriya Yoga, which is what you're doing on the same thing on the subtle and the energetic level. So we're working on increasing our biology and our internal awareness at the same time. And then that leads more into these kind of psychedelic sound healing practices that we do. And I'm traveling all over the world doing that as well.
Nice. That sounds really interesting. So where are you at in that process? Like, can we get it?
Not yet. Right.
Come on. I'm like, ready. Let me try it.
So that will be launched in August. We're on track for August. We're just in the end stages of our all of our research and development, and everything is looking really amazing. So that Great. Should be available on metahuman.com this coming August.
Great. Well, we'll keep people updated when that is available. I will put that in the description. Right, and we'll let people know.
Thank you.
You know, and thanks for coming on today. And where can people find you? Where are you mostly on? Like, where are you? Like, some people are mostly on Instagram. Some people are YouTube. Right. Some people aren't even on anything. Like, what's going on with you?
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time building my Instagram, but I'm feeling like that's the best thing. So Joshua Lee Hanna on Instagram. That's the best way to find me. Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
All right, man. Great episode.
All right, Nick. Thank you so much.
Woo! Also, I did just want to let you know again that Josh is going to be leading a breathwork journey, a full journey in my 7 days to timeline shift challenge starting on June 14th. And you can check out the description for more information on that. And there's early bird pricing depending on when you're seeing this. So check it out sooner than later if you want to get a discount on that. And he'll be going incredibly deep into how to timeline shift. That's just day one, by the way. We've got another day where we've got a human design expert talking about how to use your strategy and authority to really step into who you came to be on this planet. And that is the gist. It's not just shifting timelines to manifest more for your ego. It's about genuinely aligning to what your heart and your soul knows that it's here to do. And if you don't even know what that is yet, that's part of it, right? So this is for someone who's at the beginning stages of, I don't even know what that is. And it's also for someone who knows what that is, but doesn't know how to actualize it. So
this is going to be an incredible community of souls who are coming together to raise their energy and truly transform and shift their timeline. If you want to be in that, again, I highly recommend it. The link's going to be down below. And we'll see you in the next episode of Universe of Game. And until then, peace.